The Book Thinger podcast is a lively discussion about romance books, culture, and feelings. This is episode 25 featuring Mina V. Esquerra in Metro Manila. Book Thinger would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this episode was produced and pay respects to their elders both past and present.
Welcome to the Book Thinger podcast, talking about books we love, especially romance. Kill a fairy.
Welcome back to the Book Thinger podcast. I'm Kat Mayo from bookthinger.com.au, an Aussie blog for romance readers. This episode kicks off a series of interviews that I recorded in the Philippines with authors, readers, and people working in the local book industry. And there's no better guest to do this with than Mina V. Esquerra, whose influence in English language romances set in the Philippines really can't be underestimated. We use a couple of terms that might need a quick explanation. Pinoy is a colloquial term that Filipinos use to refer to ourselves, like how we call Australians Aussie. Tagalog is the dominant local language in the Philippines, and it's the language you would be talking about if you talk about the Filipino language. When you mention Taglish, it's a way of speaking where you code switch between English and Tagalog, which I would say is probably the most common way Filipinos would speak in English in an informal setting. We also talk about pandesal abs. Pandesal is a Filipino bread roll that is shaped pretty much like fantasy abs. I'll include a photo as well as all the books we talk about in this episode in the show notes at bookthinger.com.au/podcast. Click on episode 25.
It was one of those bucket list item things. I loved reading Sweet Dreams, Sweet Valley, romances, YA when I was growing up. Thought I would be a writer because Elizabeth Wakefield was a writer, and thought I would be one throughout high school and college. Realized that maybe it's not the best career to really commit to, so I still liked writing but didn't think that anybody could really be a full-time novelist, not just in this country but anywhere. So I just put it off as something I'd like to do before I turn 30, maybe. So I wrote a romance, finished it before I turned 30, and then shopped it around to publishers. It's actually a YA. Never got published. I also, like, hid it. I've hidden it away.
Is it one of those, I'm so glad no one published my first manuscript?
Yeah, but of course there's like an editor somewhere who has a copy of it. But it's this kind of like a localized Sweet Dreams, which is what I thought I should start with because I love Sweet Dreams and thought that there was nothing like it being published here in the Philippines. So I wrote that story, and it was, I think, 2008 when I shopped it around to a publisher, and they said that they didn't publish YA, but they thought I had some skill in writing. So at the time, Chick Lit was
this is Filipino publishers.
Yes, Filipino publishers. So I thought, you know, I got a foot in the door. A publisher was interested, but they wanted something for, at the time, was the Chick Lit market, 20-something main characters, more about careers than high school. So I wrote that instead. So we kind of shelved the whole YA thing. What ended up getting published was my imaginary ex.
So did you use any patterns to write that first book?
That book, My Imaginary Ex, I kind of paced it and wrote it like a rom-com, a romantic comedy movie, because I had started on a draft that I was working on with my editor, and it wasn't working. I was trying to write it YA style, but with older characters, and there was no drama. There was no. I kept getting revision comments, just add more drama, add more excitement. And then I said, you know, I think after months of going back and forth, I said, I'm not going to do this anymore. Let's just start over. And I wrote the book that eventually got published as if I were plotting a rom-com.
Right, because when I read it, it doesn't have the same structure as a romance. Even some of the other romances that you've written, or some of the chick lit
stories that you've written, most of it kind of happens as a flashback and then back to the present to tie up the loose ends.
Yes, that I imagined that more as a movie.
So when you began writing, when you first published that book, what sort of other romance fiction was available for Pinoy readers?
When I was writing that and when that was published, there was a lot of Tagalog romance. So that was very developed already.
And there's still a lot.
Yes, and yeah. There's still a lot, and they still release like dozens of new titles a month.
They're like maybe a third the size of a Mills and Boone, but they're kind of branded similar to the way Mills and Boone brand is branded.
Yes, and they're in supermarkets, they're in convenience stores, they're really cheap, very accessible, and they have several imprints and different genres, so it's conceptualized almost as Mills and Boone style, but in Tagalog, in the vernacular. And I read a lot of English language books and wanted to try writing English language romance, but with Filipino characters. So that's kind of how I started. But we didn't have a template for that, at least for romance. The ones that we had that were influential to me were A Chick Lit Line by Summit Media that came out in the, I think, early 2000. There's several books. It was done chick lit style. It was an entire series. It sort of covered different types of, like, the modern Filipina woman, different aspects of that story. So that was what a lot of us who ended up writing after were influenced by, because they were writing, it was mostly in English. They still included some Tagalog dialogue and phrases, but most of it was in English. So when we started writing romance in English, we were influenced by that and kind of patterned the stories after that.
Was it difficult to write something other than what you were used to reading?
In the beginning, yeah. And also just that I didn't know if it would seem right to me, reading something just with all this dialogue of people speaking in English when as friends, when you talk here in the Philippines, you'd probably have a mix of everything. And then I got over it. I kind of got into this mood and groove that this was a translation. I was documenting a conversation between friends, and I was translating the entire thing. So that's how I started writing it. And then other people picked up on it, and now I think people are getting used to reading an entire novel in English.
Do you think a style has emerged?
I think we're still looking for what it is. I don't know. I mean, you started reading.
Yeah, yeah, I noticed. It's harder for me because for me, not only do I notice the structural differences, I notice the language differences as well, because some of it are things that I struggled with when I moved to Australia. Mm-hmm. And didn't realize that my English was slightly different until someone pointed it out. And then you're like, no, my English is correct. They're like, no, really, it's not. I'm like, oh. Yeah. So it's just little subtle things like that I noticed. But I did notice that, first of all, I'm never sure if it's going to end happily, which in a romance is a little bit tough as a reader.
Yeah, I think that happens because if you read books by Filipino authors growing up, there are not a lot of happy endings. There are not a lot of happy endings. I was really surprised by that. It seems like a thing that is reserved for children's lit or fairy tales or fantasy or something. Anything that claims to be real has to be unhappy in some way.
I mean, a lot of the canon, I guess, of Philippine literature has to do with the Philippine identity and coming out of the history of colonization, which most of those stories are going to be really sad.
Yes.
But the Pinoy romances I've read don't touch on any of those issues.
Well, I'm also trying to see, I'm trying to step back and see, because happily we have enough writers writing now that we can step back and see an entire shelf if we had all of the books together and maybe trace the themes, look at styles, and it's starting to happen. The way that we are sort of encouraging each other to write happy endings is because we're trying to follow romance as everyone else in the world reads romance. I personally like the way romance is written when other nationalities and cultures write it. I have like sad ending fatigue because it's a thing that people seem to accept as a reality. Like they expect it from movies, they expect it from TV shows, they expect it from books. And I kind of feel that it's harder and it requires more creativity to write a happy ending when culturally everyone is telling you that sad is real. So that's what I do, and that's what I hopefully encourage other authors to do. Like, how can we create happy stuff in light of all of this?
I think it was you who recommended Jennifer Halleck's historical romance Under the Sugar Sun. And one of the issues I have with that as a Filipino reader is that even the happy ending feels tainted to me by even my very limited knowledge of historical facts. Whereas it doesn't bother me that Regency romance has happy endings, you know, even though there's war that happens afterwards, these people go, you know, lose all their land or whatever, and the property sort of goes into disrepair. Yeah. How do we separate that historical baggage from the, I guess, uplifting fiction that we want to write?
I don't even know, because I read that book too, and I thought about it. Like, I thought about my feelings about that book for a long time, for hours, and I had a book hangover, just thinking about what does this mean? Why am I rooting for this couple? And why do I feel so sad that they have a happy ending, but I know that it's not really happy? And I like that it's there, though. I mean,
that it exists, I like that someone began writing it.
Right? Writing it, because I think that was a tough nut to crack for lot of local authors. And I met someone who wanted to write historical, and she felt that she only could write Regency because it was like a puzzle to find a period that she could set it in here.
Well, it's not a unique issue to Filipino authors, because I haven't seen any really Australian historical romance either.
Oh, okay.
And what I've heard is similar, that they can't find a period in the history where they think a happy ending will fit comfortably. And another author said to me, well, that's just ridiculous, because actually in real life there were a lot of happy endings that occurred during Australian history.
Yes.
And when we think about subgenres like American Westerns, that was a really rough time, a really difficult time for women even, but we managed to set stories there that fulfill all the feelings that we need for a romance without having to worry about some of the more problematic aspects.
I know, and I think because I also just started reading historical romances again last year, so I did a binge of all these historical romances that were kind of showing how modern women could be and in that time, but in a way that I guess some people were seeing it as anachronistic, but I was seeing it as, of course, there were people who were like this back then, because human nature is how it is, and they were acting the same way. So I appreciated that series, that, or at least that book, Under the Sugar Sun, because I felt that it found certain elements. Now, when you think about it, it becomes a little problematic, because it uses elements that we don't consider, like a hero that would normally be a villain in a different story, and just a female main character who isn't Filipino. So this is kind of not something that a Filipino would write if we would start a project like this. But I really appreciate, though, that she showed, that the author Jennifer Halleck showed that it could be written, and maybe it just requires a little more pushing to see where else we can set this.
I mean, I wonder if it helped that she was not as steeped in the culture as somebody
and
who was
baggage.
Born here.
Yeah,
yeah. yeah. She didn't have that baggage. I mean, I hesitate to say that because she has lived here. She probably knows modern Filipino culture better than I do, and I think she studied the history, so really, between the two of us, she knows more about it than I do, so who am I to complain? But for me, I felt like the fresh eyes that she gives to that historical context allowed her to write a story like that. Because I was like, a sugar baron is really problematic. There's like all these class issues that are just never addressed.
Yes.
I'm glad it was the heroine who was American and not the guy, so it was a little bit less problematic. But the whole thing, so spoilers, the whole third act was just, I
that
wanted
was
to
exhausting.
Strangle the lady. I was like, come on.
That was exhausting. And I think if we were to do a discussion with fellow Filipinos, we would really take that third act and just strangle certain people.
I think it brought up issues that were really interesting, but just weren't the point of the story. Mm-hmm. And they were so distracting. Yeah. So distracting.
Yes. But again, I think because that's like someone looking at it from a different perspective. So it's like, oh, okay. I didn't realize that someone would do it that way.
And, but also, yeah. I think if we want to target readers who are not Filipino as well, then it probably doesn't really matter. It's similar to a lot of the Regencies where they skip over things that somebody who studies history would throw the book across the
room. And I don't
room.
Mind, right? Yeah. I don't mind, for example, that they're clean.
Yeah, that's right. That they don't smell.
Yeah,
I don't brush their teeth.
I don't mind certain things. So, yeah. So I kind of tried to read it in that way. But I think to connect it to what I am writing, and because I write contemporary, and I kind of committed to writing happy things. Romance that's not so weighed down by everything else that Philippine media seems to think that we should be talking about. So I got some feedback early on that it wasn't representative of life.
Authentic. You're glossing over the
bad
parts.
Yeah, I'm glossing over bad parts. Where are the slums?
It's really hard to write that romance.
Exactly.
I mean, it can be done.
Yeah, where are certain things? Or why does everyone have a positive outlook in life? Why do they seem to have bright futures? And a lot of writers I know actually have to be guided through that.
But also I feel like, so I've also started dabbling in writing, because when I discovered Binoy Romance, it was like, that's the kind of thing that I kind of think maybe I want to write. Mm-hmm. Not so much the English set romances, but even as somebody who hasn't lived here for almost 30 years, you kind of feel an obligation mm-hmm. to represent the most marginalized people in society, because there's so many of them.
Yes.
So when you write something, yes. I actually feel like I'm perpetuating some sort of class issue that is already rampant.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, it's not impossible. We have a lot of NA that deals with like heroines who are stripping for a living, who are sort of really living in poverty and trying to get out of it. And then the hero, I mean, it's the hero who saves them, but you can always flip that trope, right? In the Philippines, you can have the hero who's trying to get out of poverty, and then
we're still trying to explore that, actually. So I think, yeah, the cool thing about being able to read all of these romance books and then thinking of how to apply those stories here, I think it's exciting. And we've been trying to encourage that, at least in the community of people writing. Just start writing stuff. It can be a lot of things. We're still trying to figure out what we can write about and how. So the whole aspect of what to include, like about class struggles, about money, about poverty, and everything else is, I think we're starting to figure out how to put it in.
So part of your work as a romance author and advocate is mentoring up-and-coming writers. And you founded the Romance Class Group, which is a group on Facebook, but it's also like a productive sort of author mentoring and reader outreach kind of group. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
It kind of became that one day. I just said, I'm not planning to write a contemporary romance this year, because I was in the middle of finishing something that was fantasy oriented, and I said, I'm not going to write contemporary romance. And then I didn't want to not be able to read anything contemporary that year, so I said, let's try this, let's write some, I'll help you write something, I'll give you an outline. And then 100 people joined. So we started a Facebook group just to keep track of everything. And it's the same group that exists today. The class is over. People ended up just being in the group to, first of all, keep in touch. So it's people who joined the original group and have since written something, published something, and people who are joining the group because they've read the books. And now I opened up the class again this year, so there are more people who joined and people who are interested in reading and becoming authors. So what we've tried to define the group to be is that we're writing romance in English, and that's become a very specific thing, because you can be Filipino and write romances in Tagalog. And
do those markets intersect? The Pinoy romance, the Pinoy language romances, and the English language romances.
I think if you do a Venn diagram of it, there are some intersections, but they're very narrow. I can identify, for example, some people who write romance in English but also write Tagalog romance, or read romance in English but also read Tagalog romance, or write Wattpad, Taglish, YA, and also read this. But they're very specific people, and it's not necessarily an entire large audience that can freely, like, overlap with each other. It seems to be still, like, separate groups.
So, and you guys have been doing some really interesting things to do with producing the books that I don't think I've seen anywhere else. Things like the podcasts with the audio narrations. The cover projects featuring...
Yes.
I think you were telling me they were featured style bloggers in the beginning.
Yes.
And you guys are producing study aids for the books so that they can be taught at schools.
Yes.
You have, like, a scholarship thing that you kind of do on the side.
I mean, thank you. Thank you for listing all of that down.
But no, but they're really interesting because I was at the RT convention, and you guys, they're actually following you guys really closely. I went to the Rip Bodice, the bookstore. They had your books there.
Yes,
and they're following your activities
really closely. Thank you for posting that picture. I was like, that's...
Yeah, so... You know, this is an established market that has been around for so many years, but they haven't thought to do some of the things that you guys are doing.
I mean, all of these things are sort of accidents of us having to be creative because we didn't have access to certain things. Like the podcast started off with us wondering if we could do audiobooks, just in breaking down how much it would cost. Like, we couldn't do a full audiobook. And first of all, like, how do you spend this much time in a recording studio, hours and hours, paying someone? And then what if it's not the right book? You spend all of that time and resources on a book that doesn't do well. And we kind of didn't want to risk that, to throw everything into one project. So we thought, let's just do scenes, like the best scenes from each book. We get the same two people to read them, and then it worked.
And it's like a teaser for the
It's like a
book.
Teaser. And because I like using these things, if I've already paid for them and they're already out there, I like using them in other ways. So just recently, I used them as, like, teaching tools in a workshop. And they were really effective. First of all, it gave the workshop some depth because it wasn't just me talking all the time. There was, like, participation. And especially when I show them videos of the live readings of the actors, like, and then there's audience.
Yeah, but there are extra feelings involved when it's live, right?
Yeah.
It also depends on who reading
it. And what they look like and what they're reading. But that's it. I think that was really educational. Even for me, teaching a workshop, the scholarship came about because I was invited to speak at a government university, which is actually the National Teacher Center of the country. It's a university that's focus is educating teachers. And these are people who will be teaching in the public schools all over the country. So they invited me, and then I just discovered that the tuition fee was really affordable. And I couldn't believe that you could still go to college, and you could still go to college for that much. And of course, the heartbreaking thing was some students still couldn't afford it. Because tuition is just the beginning. If you're teaching literature, and we sponsored literature teachers, they need books. They need access to books. They're always having to read certain things. They always need to find certain books, and that's just the beginning. So that came out of that. The covers, the project with
the
covers.
I love that. When I've been telling people all about that, and they're like, why didn't we think of that? Because a lot of... I mean, there are a lot of indie and self-published authors overseas as well, and so they have to cover the cost of their cover art and cover imagery, and I don't think anybody has ever done
that. That was so cool because it started off as one of those creative, like, accidents, because it was a study. I was supposed to... The first cover that I did that had a style blogger on the cover, I was supposed to hire an artist. And he used a photo of his friend and said, I'm going to draw something and it's going to look like this. And then I said, I'm just going to get this photo. Who's your friend? I'm just going to get this photo. And then, like, and then of course, after that, it's like, of course.
It's like an aha moment.
Yeah. It's like, why weren't we doing this before? Why style bloggers in particular? Because they have fabulous clothes and their photos of themselves are great. if you actually just go through a style blogger's blog, you'll see all of these different looks. But the problem, I guess, if you're an indie author, is you have to have some sort of relationship with the blogger, because they don't just want their photo on any book. They might be particular about what the book's about.
Right, especially yeah. if you're writing romance or exactly. steamy scenes or whatever.
Exactly. So there's some trust involved. So that's kind of what led to the cover photo project, rather than contact individual people and then have them do individual transactions with each other and dealings. We just got we're starting to get people who could be our characters, who look Filipino.
Oh, that's the other thing. So yeah. it's impossible to find a brown-skinned Filipino cover model. Like,
yes.
impossible. Like, impossible. And I actually put this challenge out to Twitter and no one could find it.
Yes. If you're searching for Asian, right, there's like an Asian look that in stock photo photography that doesn't stock photos
right
everywhere.
And you have to, like, half of it you have to discard because they're kind of porny and they yeah. don't really fit, right?
Yeah, but that's just beginning, so we're
no, but even that I think is ahead of the curve. I think I've only heard of Courtney Milan doing a cover project with diverse models.
Yes, because she couldn't find
right.
photos
she
for
her.
She
had the same problem.
Yeah, yeah, so we're trying to do that. But I sort of cast them with my characters in mind.
As you do.
Yeah, with my characters in mind. But they could be, I mean, if you can use the photo, then
right, because it's
it.
A matter
yeah.
of volume, right?
Yes.
If you
yes.
get enough, eventually you will be able to meet most people's needs.
And as we were shooting that, like, one of our models said, are you looking for someone who looks like blah blah? And because they know they have friends, and they were recommending their friends for the next one.
Right.
And like, okay, we just need to raise the money, and yes, we'll have every all kinds.
Because my request is abs, right?
Yeah.
Men yes. with abs.
Yes, yes, yes.
I have to ask for pandesal abs, not like pizza abs.
No. Pandesal. We have to educate the foreign audience on pandesal.
Yeah, the ones that are perfectly formed.
We have a wish list. I mean, for the covers, we have a wish list, like short-haired females.
Yes.
Plus size.
Oh, right, so because I was looking
hair.
For short-haired yeah. brown skin.
Yeah.
Or long, curly-haired brown.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a wish list, so the people who showed up to be our models were so, like, they were recommending their friends. So all we need now is, like, the money to...
The resources.
Yeah, the money to pay them. Because we don't want them doing this for free. Yeah, I mean, it's their time and their faces and their...
Getting a tiny bit political. The Philippines has just gone through a very interesting election. You've recently released a story called The Future Chosen on Radish.
Yes.
Which is an app-based publishing platform. And I've heard you describe it as a utopian story, and it features a couple who can't be together. I think this is what it is, because I've read a bit of it.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple who can't be together because they're expected to be the heir apparents to their political families.
Yes.
And there's an anti-dynasty law that says a family can only have one person in politics.
Yes.
So I'm really fascinated by this premise and how you got the idea. Is this wishful thinking on your part?
I started writing it. It was a short story that I wrote 3 years ago during another election. It wasn't a presidential election. It was a midterm election for senators. I think the highest position was for senators. And just how crazy political every Filipino gets during elections. So I just started thinking, I guess elections have different flavors every time. And we, depending on who's running, we kind of focus on different things. So I think at the time, people were so against the children of politicians running in that particular election. So I sort of use that as a plot bunny that we keep talking about, preventing certain people from running, and yet we claim to be a democracy. So let's just run with that. Let's say that it's a law that you cannot run. Or you cannot marry someone who's already if you're a politician, you can't marry someone who's a politician.
I feel like it's kind of a Romeo and Juliet, but with society as the villain, I guess.
Yeah. So I sort of started plotting it as a dystopia, and then I realized, no, wait, this is what everyone
you're right.
claims to want. This is what everyone claims to want, that you don't have all of these families in power, multiple generations of politicians controlling everything. And then as I started plotting it, it took a while. This longer for me to actually develop into a full book that it is.
Honestly,
now.
I read the short story and I'm like, I don't even know how she's going to get herself out of this one. Like, it's one of those things where you want to know the ending, but you're scared to find out.
Yeah, I didn't want to write it because I had like, because it sort of goes against everything that I've been writing so far, because I didn't want society to win. I wanted them to win, but of course, then eventually I was able to outline it in such a way that I was happy with how it was going to end. But
so related to that, can romance fiction make political statements?
I think so. I think we are just starting to discover how we can do that. I think the progression of that is, yes, first we started allowing ourselves to write romance. And then, at least for me, I've written more than 20 books now, but it's taken a while for me to feel that I could tackle certain topics like societal problems, not just political. So this is a very Future Chosen is a very overtly political story, but even just other things, just being able to insert those things and not scare people away who just want to read romance. I think eventually, if you kind of have that track in mind, you can start doing it. But I have read people who actually have the political or societal aspect in mind, and when they start writing, I think it weighs the story down, and
it competes
with the romance, and it's no longer a romance. So that's, I think, the balance that we have to learn, that you have to decide if it's romance first, and then what else it is, and figure out the right recipe for it. Because again, maybe it ends up not pleasing anyone if it's too heavy for one audience or too light for another.
Final question. I know you're a huge fan of Hamilton. Why is it important who tells our stories?
Okay, I really, really love how Hamilton sort of like tells us all of these things about who should tell our story. And it's taken me a while to figure out what story I should tell, but I kind of felt underrepresented myself, which is so strange to say, because I feel that it's almost as if my story, when you look at all of this literature that's coming out of my country and other countries, it feels like my story is not important to tell. It feels like there are more important stories to tell, but if I don't put it out there, then it disappears. No one ever finds out about it. And the cool thing about writing this anyway, even if it feels like a small story that only a few people can relate to, is that eventually I found people who felt that it was for them. So this is something that I've managed to say in panels and in talks as well, that what I'm trying to do right now is for my story not to be everything, but hopefully just be everything to someone. And hopefully that helps.
I hope you enjoyed that as much as I love chatting with Mina. If you have any feedback or suggestions, you can send me a tweet at BookThingo or send an email to podcast@bookthingo.com.au. You can find the show notes at bookthingo.com.au/podcast. Just click on episode 25. Many, many thanks to our long-suffering audio producer, Rudy Bremer. If you tuned in to our previous episode, you might have realized that Mina has released another book since this interview. Iris After the Incident is such a great book, featuring a heroine and a hero who are both recovering from sex scandals, and done in a way that is sensitive and sexy and empowering. I've been recommending this book to everyone looking for fresh heroine tropes. I have a few shout-outs this week, which is so great because Rudy and I love hearing from you. First up, one of our regular listeners, Charles Tan, wants more podcasts with socks, which is further proof that Gabby's influence on our listeners is immense. Last episode, Gabby talked about her indoor sock fetish. So to honor her fans, I am recording this outro while wearing socks. Sarah, who tweets as BlueStocking_A, and who happens to be a friend of the Book Thingo bloggers, said listening to the Book Thingo podcast and Gabby claiming that she didn't want to be yelly made my day. And last but not least, Diem, who left us a review on iTunes a few months ago, also mentioned us on her podcast called Bookish Friends. She mentioned Adele Walsh's new adult romance reading list. I've updated the show notes for episode 23 with a link, and I'll include it in the show notes for this episode too. If you haven't tuned in to Bookish Friends, you should definitely check them out, especially if you love young adult, new adult, or romance. Thank you so much to everyone who sent us their feedback and comments. If you enjoyed the podcast, you can help support us by leaving a review on iTunes and, of course, visiting bookthingo.com.au to check out reviews and opinions from a bunch of readers from Down Under, including Rudy, Gabby, and me. In the next episode, I talk to two Filipino indie authors, Suzette de Borja and Six de los Reyes. We chat about science, sexy times, and stigma. Until then, I hope you have a fabulous fortnight of reading.